Okay, let's continue with agenda paper 10, annual cohorts. Anne.
So we've received a submission about annual groups of contracts with policyholders that all share in the return on a specified pool of underlying items. And that means that some of the return on those underlying items contractually passes from one group of policyholders to another in specific situations. And for these contracts, the submission asks in what circumstances does measuring the contractual service margin at a higher level than the annual cohort level, so say the portfolio level, in what circumstances would that achieve the same accounting outcome as measuring the contractual service margin at the annual cohort level as required by IFRS 17? The reason for asking the question is that the paragraph in the basis, BC138, says that the IFRS 17, specifies the amounts that you have to report in a set of financial statements, not the methodology that you use to arrive at those amounts. And so if you can get to the same answer as using annual cohorts without using annual cohorts, then you don't need to use annual cohorts. I think it's important to remember that that paragraph in the basis explains, a consequence of how standards work. It explains a consequence of the requirements of IFRS 17. It doesn't in any way change the requirements of the standard. So to determine in practice whether you need to identify annual cohorts, you need to look at the requirements in IFRS 17 to see what would happen if you used annual cohorts and whether you could get to that answer using annual cohorts by doing something else. We also think it's worth noting that, BC 138 also says that the board did not want to establish a set of rules that determined when you could get to the same answer as you would get to using annual cohorts by not using annual cohorts, because the basis says that the board concluded that setting the boundary for such a sort of an exception from using annual cohorts would add complexity to IFRS 17 and create the risk that the boundary would not be robust or appropriate in all circumstances. So given that, in terms of discussing this issue today, we think it would be most helpful if the TRG discussion focused not on the different views that were set out in the submission, which are in paragraph 12 of the paper, but on the staff analysis in paragraphs 13 to 19. And those paragraphs explain what factors might lead to the same or different accounting outcomes, and then apply those. It applies the requirements of the standard to some specific fact patterns. So if we could focus our discussion on those. And then turning to those examples, we have an example where contracts with the policyholders share in 100% of the returns on a pool of underlying items. And the underlying items are the insurance contracts that are issued to the policyholders. So the policyholders fully share the risks in the insurance contracts. And there, that means that the entity is not ultimately affected by the expected cash flows of the individual contracts issued. And for those contracts, if you apply paragraph B68 of IFRS 17, the contractual service margin ends up being nil. And therefore, for those contracts in that specific fact pattern, an entity could measure the contractual service margin at a higher level than the annual cohort level because it's going to be nil. And that would achieve the same accounting outcome as using annual cohorts. And that's illustrated in example one of the appendix. In contrast, contracts with policyholders that do not fully share the risks, that aren't 100% sharing in the risks, that means that the entity could be affected by the expected cash flows of each contract issued, and therefore applying paragraph B68 of IFRS 17, You do reflect the risk sharing between the groups of contracts, but that still means that the entity is left exposed to some risk. And therefore, the contractual service margin of the groups of contracts could differ from the contractual service margin measured at a higher level. And that's illustrated in example two of appendix to the paper. And so we'll ask for your views on the staff analysis.
Thanks, Anne. Leslie?
Thank you. I think the key to me in paragraph 19 is the word could. It could cause the entity to be affected by the expected cash flows of each contract issued. Then the example actually takes the example where it does. So my concern is that there's a danger that the conclusion that 100% risk sharing is required before you get this the same answer using annual cohorts or not might be inadvertently extended to all different structures. And I don't think that's appropriate, because I think there are structures where you don't have 100% risk sharing where you would still get the same answer with annual cohorts. In particular, there's no discussion of UC on page 6, but I'm not going to go there. My read of the words of the standard is B68 tells you not to double count. B69 gives you an example of what you mean by not double counting. And then B70 allows for different allocations, approaches to the allocation, as long as the approach is systematic and rational. And I would choose the systematic and rational approach in the context of providing useful information to the users. So that could be the same way the staff did it in example two, but it need not be the same as the way the staff did it in example two. And in particular, I could envision a situation where you would allocate the cash flows in a manner that makes each group whole before the risk sharing arrangement. Now, why might I do that? I have to divert a little bit into an actuarial discussion. Forgive me here. My concern is that a quote-unquote loss on a particular annual cohort might not actually be meaningful or useful information if it's the result of merely a statistical anomaly as opposed to a bad group. You know, a group where you had bad underwriting or set the prices incorrectly. It could just be that the deaths you had this year happened to be in that cohort as opposed to another cohort, just by happenstance. The problem is that the annual cohort's experience in a particular reporting period may not be credible information. So you wouldn't want to reflect that basically anomalous or unusual or statistical fluctuations in the results of a particular period. So that is just a consideration that I would apply in deciding how to allocate the fulfillment cash flows among the annual cohort. Thank you.
I just say we're not making a general conclusion that you have to have 100% sharing. But we are saying you need to be able to know in advance that not using annual cohorts will give you the same answer as using annual cohorts, you know, however expectations develop and experience develops. So you need to think very carefully.
Agreed.
Okay, Sue?
And I think that, just building on what Anne just said there, the fact that in the example the staff says you could get this difference is important.
Mm. Agreed.
Yes.
Okay, Sechar?
Thank you. I'm fine with example one, yeah. I have similar issue with what was mentioned by Leslie regarding example two, from a different perspective, not so much from the actual perspective, but from just applying IFRS 17. Let me go through my analysis with you. Yeah. you look at paragraph B70 of IFRS 17, it says different practical approaches can be used. And now you need to, entity shall allocate the effect of a change in the underlying items to each group on a systematic and rational basis. That's what B70 say. And in B68, it mentioned the fulfillment cash flow of each group reflect the extent to which contract in the group caused the entity. Now here it doesn't have the word could. It says you caused the entity to be affected by expected cash flow, or whether to policy in that group or to policy in another group. Okay. The key is that extent. I believe you need to reflect the full extent of the impact of those cash flow. The allocation in A15 of the paper, I believe, does not reflect the full extent of the cash flow from a different group of policyholder. So I believe there would be a more rational way to do that allocation. The result of A15 would overstate the loss component of Group 1 and also overstate the CSM of Group 2 to 10. Because you look at what the fact patterns of this whole portfolio is about. Yeah, it's about sharing of those gain and losses. Yeah. Now, an alternative approach. Maybe let me explain the alternative approach. Yeah. You can get that by applying B69. Okay. You look at the B69. It says the extent of that payment to policyholder in one group are reduced from a share in the returns on underlying items. You know, it give you the example, 350 to 250, and the full extent is 100. Okay, and it say this reflect payments of a guaranteed amount to policyholder in another group. Yeah, you look at the fact patterns on page 14. Okay, there are two tables there. The upper table for group one. I just focus on the column for group one. Yes. That payment arising from guarantee made to policyholder in that group, that's 3,000. Because you get premium of 1,000, claim of 4,000, you got a loss. So that guarantee, it's 3,000. That's what the B69 say. You got to reflect the guarantee. And it's the full extent of the guarantee. The example in B69 say, you know, 350 minus 250 give you 100. You don't take a portion of that 100. You reflect the full 100. Yeah. Same thing here. The guarantee here is the 3,000 before you go to the sharing of the pool, which is the 540 here. So reflecting that in paragraph A14, you know, taking into account B69, I believe, you know, the under group one, the share return on pool, instead of being 2,700 as shown here, should be 3,000. So, which is the full guaranteed amount to policyholder. It shouldn't be just 90% of the guarantee. It should be the full extent of that. Yeah. So if you work the numbers out, you know, this is 3,000, and then you translate that into the table on A15. The key is that paragraph B68 of IFRS 17. Instead of 3,240, you use this logic reflecting the full extent of the impact of cash flow to policyholder. That number should be 3,540, and then the net effect of that is group one should have a zero loss component, and group 2 to 10 will have overall fulfillment cash flow of 600 and a CSM of 600. So that will be my suggestion of a more rational allocation of the cash flow based on paragraph B67 to B70.
I don't agree with that analysis, but I don't know, Daryl, do you want to?
Sure. So I was initially going to comment just in response to what Leslie said, and then I'll pick up your comment, I think. So I think all of the things about rational and thinking about that is absolutely the way that you think about applying paragraph 24 and the other paragraphs. I don't think anything in BC 138 affects that at all. So I would almost split those two discussions out. And I think you apply the standard as you would apply the standard. And if, as a consequence of you applying the standard and the words in the standard the way the words have been set out, you conclude that you would not get a difference if you were putting things together, then that's a conclusion you could come to. And I agree with others who've said that we shouldn't see these examples as being absolute. These were two examples we were given. I think on your point, I think the important thing for me about B68 is it talks about to the extent. And so when I think about the to the extent, what I'm thinking about is how does this affect policyholders and how does it affect the shareholder or the company itself? And when I look at this particular example, I then ask myself a very simple question. Is the company worse off because it issued the Group 1 contracts? Is it worse off as a consequence of that? And it is worse off to the extent that it reduces its share that it would otherwise have got from Groups 2 to 10. And that determines how much actually transfers between the two entities. Now, I agree B69, because it's a very simplified example, seems to imply the whole amount. But you go back to the words in B68, and B68 talks about to the extent, and it's clear in this circumstance, if I did not have Group 1, I as a company would have been better off because I would have been able to take my whole 10% from Group 1 instead of having to give up some of my 10% to compensate. And I think the two sets of numbers, the numbers you were talking about, are essentially saying, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ignore the fact that I'm losing my 10% on that little bit and only look at what the cash flows look like afterwards. I think that goes against the spirit of what would I have achieved if I had looked at them each individually.
And just to follow up on that, I think the difference is that in the example, in the fact pattern that we're looking at in the paper, Group 1 and Groups 2 to 10 are sharing in the overall result of the pool. Now, the very simple example in B69 is just talking about a guaranteed amount to the policyholders in one group, and it doesn't say that it's actually then sharing in anything else. So if you look at the fact pattern in the paper and you compare what the cash flows of Group 1 and would be if Groups 2 to 10 didn't exist, and then what it is if Groups 2 to 10 do exist, you get the figure of 3240 as being the amount that is the amount by which the cash flows in Group 1 is affected by the existence of Groups 2 to 10. So I do think that the way that we've come up with these figures in the paper is what B68 requires. And it might look a bit different from the example in B69, but that's because it's a different fact pattern. And for the fact pattern in the paper, these figures reflect the requirements of B68.
Well if we look at, first of all, we should let's agree whether we are dealing with the same guarantee for the two examples. So example one and example two basically have the same numbers. The difference is in the sharing, okay? And in terms of guarantee to policyholder, they are the same.
Well, so that's except 3,000, they're not, because right? The sharing affects the amount that the
right. Before we go into sharing, we could address the key thing is what is the guarantee to the policyholder? The guarantee in each group is quite clear. In the case of Group 1, because of the experience, the guarantee kick in, that's 3,000, same as in Group 2. That same guarantee, you can't run away from that guarantee because, it's guaranteed to the Group 1 policyholder. And if you look at B67, it talk about the payment should include guarantees made to policyholder. That's why I have problem with A14.
I don't think the guarantees are the same in the two examples, because the transfer of the cash flows or the amounts due to the policyholder are all based on it sharing in the pool. It's not an absolute guaranteed amount to Group 1. It's just that it shares in the pool. So it's not that it's getting, you know, 3,000. It has to take its share of the, you know, its share of the pool as well.
A different way to say it is that the guarantee from the recipient policyholder might be the same, but the people who have to contribute to paying for that guarantee is different. In example one, the guarantee is paid for entirely by the other policyholders. In two, essentially the entity is having to contribute 10% of the guarantee, and the other policyholders put 90%
in. Yeah, I disagree, because the guarantee needs to first be fully reflected by the pool first. And then that's how, in reality, this kind of arrangement works. Yeah. So, you know, the standard doesn't go into what you mentioned. It's the way I read it is it's guaranteed the same, you know, because in your interpretation, the guarantee will be affected by the different sharing percentage.
Yes.
That doesn't make sense, yeah.
Oh, but...
But it is a fact pattern.
But then again, B68 says that the fulfillment cash flows of each group reflect the extent to which the contract in the group caused the entity to be affected. The entity is affected by the fact that it takes 10% of a pool after paying the claims. It is different to other fact patterns. So we need to see how the entity is affected. And in this specific fact pattern, we did not challenge the premiums or the claims or whether there is another way to allocate this, because this is something that an entity needs to apply the requirements, determine the fulfillment cash flows. We are focusing on applying B68 to this specific fact pattern. Looking at that specific fact pattern, I don't see how we can get a different amount of applying B68.
That's a good point. Yeah, the extent. What does that extent mean? The extent is it just each group separately, or you know, all the groups together? Yeah. So here, it say all. So you have the extent of everything. To be looked at, yeah. So that's how I think that's the fundamental difference we have here. You know, what does it mean by the word guarantee to the policyholder, and what does it mean by extend? I believe extend here means the full extend. Yeah. Here you read as the sharing extend. Yeah. So that's
It's the, you know, the fulfillment cash flows of each group reflect the extent to which the contracts in the group cause the entity to be affected by expected cash flows. So you're always looking at the contracts in the group and how do they affect the entity and how do they affect the policyholders in other groups. But you're looking at the group at that point. The words of the standard are very clear there.
Right. But then okay. If you look at A10, it's a single portfolio. So this is a single portfolio.
The portfolio is not a group. We're looking at, and B68 talks about groups.
Roma.
Thank you. I acknowledge that you said we should not go into the submission with the different views, but more on the analysis from the staff. Make one comment on the submissions. I think I agree with no one of these views because it always expresses this view A, view B, view C is the only available, is only but able.
We want to focus on the process that you go through to decide, you know, in any specific fact pattern, what process do you follow to work out whether you would get the same accounting outcomes using annual cohorts or not. And we have illustrated the process that we think you should follow, following the requirements of IFRS 17, using these two examples as illustrations. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, thank you for this clarification again. And So going then to the step analysis, I have some difficulties to follow paragraph 18, which somehow indicates that full risk sharing mean that 100% of the returns go to the policyholders, and thus the contractual service margin will be nil. I'm a bit struggling. First of all, I disagree that full risk sharing means 100% of returns need to go to the policyholders, and the CSM is nil in these situations. I think full risk sharing would for me mean that the entity share, so the shareholder share, is not affected. And so I could even have 20% shareholder share, but mutualization principles, which prevent me that this share is affected by changes in underlying cash flows from underlying items. So the shareholder share would remain unaffected because of mutualization, even if there's a shareholder share. I think this example where the shareholder share is zero is for me a bit useless, I must say, because if there is no CSM, I don't need to have any measurement principles for the CSM. So and all the coverage unit discussion we had, coverage period, and then also annual cohort and level of aggregation is only relevant finally for the CSM. So if there's no CSM, we can go to lunch. So I have not understood why you put it to this extreme, because it's not helpful for the discussion, because I think this everyone could conclude if there's no CSM, no annual cohorts are needed to measure the CSM. So I also accept that we don't discuss different fact patterns, but please allow me to make the comment that for me, full risk sharing is more than having only a CSM of zero, because 100% of the returns go to the policyholder. And then also if I listen to the discussion, I think one of the fundamental difficulties in this discussion is that usually these examples somehow assume that we have cash flows we can clearly attribute to the groups of contracts. And in real world, and I'm not now drawing an alternative fact pattern, in real world very often I think this is not the case, because the returns from underlying items are only measured and available on a entity level, or at least a former subsidiary level. We can measure certain parts of the fulfillment cash flows only on an aggregated level, like option and guarantees, for example. Very often you can only you calculate them on the overall level, and then you need to allocate them downwards. And then the discretion which the entity very often has to determine what goes to the policyholder, what goes to the shareholder, is sometimes, or in cases I know, very often applied also on the entity level, where then the entity says, okay, as a shareholder return, I reserve this or this amount, and then I start to allocate down the rest, so to say, which goes into the policyholders. And very, very many of the practical examples I have in mind, this is done on a very aggregated level. So, but examples somehow assume that I have clearly identifiable cash flows. So I think it's important for me that we agree that we don't speak about allocation of cash flows here and methodologies to do so. But this will be a key discussion point, because this, I think, then is changing the result. And I think this is also acknowledged. And if you go to B70 to introduce another paragraph into the discussion, where I think it's clearly stated that very often you can only identify then if you have mutualized situations, cash flows on an aggregated level, and then you need to allocate. And this allocation is not so easy to really reflect then in the best manner some of reality and what is happening in the business. I think I don't want to be that the example two can be seen as a kind of mandatory allocation principle, but I think as expressed also by others, there can be other ways of allocation. I think if we assume that this allocation is the best and right one, I think you can come to the conclusion that you need the annual cohort. But the very critical question, I think, is how really what level you start the allocation, how to do it, and there can be different results. And also for this example, when we talk about the allocation. Thank you.
Sarah?
I was going to respond to a couple of points in there that I think are important, and I think these are maybe important as an overall thought process. So again, I think staff tend to respond, or mostly have responded, in this case have responded, directly to examples that you were presented with. So I think it is important that that's a context to bear in mind when we look at this. And maybe a request to people making submissions to also think about the examples they give us, because I think that does matter in this space. I reiterate what I said to Leslie, is I think it's important to bear in mind that the other principles that you're applying in IFRS 17 are the principles in IFRS 17, and there was a specific target of the question that we were being asked here, and I think that matters in this circumstance. There was something else I was going to say now. I think obviously the other point about examples, and I seem to remember this was in our February meeting where we talked about whether examples were useful or not. Clearly examples are a simplification. So there is an assumption that there's an assumption when you go into examples that you can do things, and other parts of 17 may allow you to think about how you do those things. So I thought that was important to remind people about.
Okay, thanks, Gerard. Massimo?
I agree with what Roman said, and so I would like to point out that I also the opinion that the example, so the paragraph 18. And the example related to this paragraph is not helpful in the sense that it seems to be a very extreme case, more probably related to mutual insurers rather than being representative of this kind of business for the insurers. But also I acknowledge what you said, and that it's not excluding that even out of this specific pattern, potentially we can apply and demonstrate that we may achieve a similar outcome with or without the application of AMA courts. But I guess it's very important to clarify that there are cases where we can demonstrate a fully sharing of risk, even if we are not in this very strict 100% zero CSM fact pattern like mentioned in paragraph 80. I also agree with what the other members said about the interpretation, or how we should interpret or see the second example, in the sense that if I have to think about the application of B70 in the context of that example, probably I would conclude in a different way. Mm-hmm. So it. In my opinion, since the characteristic of this contract is as you said, is the sharing of the pool. In my view, a reasonable outcome of the example number two in saying that at pool level we have a net cash flow of 6,000, that the share of the shareholder is 10%, and so the contractual service margin of the portfolio is 600, and then B60. May provide the tool or a rational way to allocate cash flows as CSM between the groups. And so I would tend to conclude that the picture in that case is different from the picture that has been presented in the example number two.
Yes, if the fact pattern were different, because B70 says, you know, in some cases, an entity may be able to identify the change in underlying items and resulting changes in the cash flows only at a higher level of aggregation. Now, if that were the case, as Roman was explaining, then maybe then when you're doing your systematic and rational basis of allocation, you would be able to demonstrate that using that basis, you would always get the same results using annual cohorts or not using annual cohorts. But in this fact pattern, there is a way of allocating. I mean, because we're given the cash flows for the different groups, and so they haven't been identified only at a higher level. So I think I agree with the principle that you're saying, but you can't use B70 to say, I know that the cash flows are actually arising in these groups, but I'm going to pretend I don't know and use a systematic and rational basis that is somehow different from what I know. You have to apply B70 in the circumstances for which it is designed to be applied. And if that is the case, then I agree with your conclusions. But that's not this fact pattern.
Okay, thanks, Anne. Jens?
I do find the paper very helpful. I don't disagree what has been said earlier, but I have a different reading of the paper. I do think there's, my understanding is there's a question posed in paragraph 12 by the submitter. The submitter comes up with two examples, and the question that is submitted is directly answered in para 18. This is my understanding. So please give me an example where we can do on the annual cohort level, and where, and this is, I think, perfectly addressed in para 18. And then you rephrase, this is outlined in example one, and I acknowledge that example one and two is not prepared by the staff, but my understanding is that this has been prepared by the submitter of the paper. So this is not something that the staff thought about, but it's rather the submitter prepared these examples and provided these. And 18 addresses the question in para 12. And then in 19, you go on, and I think here I want to echo what Leslie said earlier, that it's very important to capture the language where you say it could cause, and in the end you say may differ. So it's not a definitive statement that is made in 19. It's rather you answer the question in 18, and in 19 you say there is you cannot conclude from the fact pattern in example 1 that this is always the case. There might be differences, and this is addressed in 19, and then you reference to example 2 without stating that this is a fact pattern that should apply widely, but this is just in my understanding, one example. So therefore, I find this paper very helpful in that it addresses in 18 the question directly and gives some helpful hint in 19. And in the end, it depends on facts and circumstances. So and just to pick up example 2, so my understanding is not that the staff wants to express that example 1 and example 2 are conclusive. So therefore, for me, the paper is very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Jens.
But does that, can I just check the use of the word may here? Were you not suggesting that there are circumstances where the outcomes could be different and therefore that's a problem in terms of not needing to apply annual cohorts as opposed to it's an inconclusive outcome?
Yes, we are saying, we're saying that you need to be sure in advance that whatever happens, you will get to the same answer using annual cohorts as not annual cohorts. So in terms of the examples being conclusive, for the fact pattern that we were given that's illustrated in those examples, we think that the answer we get to is conclusive. And you couldn't take that fact pattern and analyze it in a different way and say, therefore, we don't need to use annual cohorts. But you...
So if I understand correctly, what the staff analysis was leading toward, subject obviously to what the TRG discussion says, would be it would be helpful if we were able to make a statement that would say that when you make this assessment of whether or not you need to apply the annual cohorts as opposed to what BC whatever was referring to, you need to assess whether it would always be the case that the outcomes would be the same.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sally.
Okay, thank you. I understand this paper, two samples is to eliminate your conclusion that, as Sue just said, that in all cases you should decide in advance. Although I share similar view as Central about the result of the second example, but I hear what you said already. I just want to make sure that because people reading this paper, someone think this is the way that we need to allocate the cash flow for the when we do the annual cohort. I just need to make sure that you make it clear it's not the way that we have to do the cash flow allocation in that way, because there's a
that real was case the way it was given to us, that allocation.
I just say it's a specific case.
It was not intended to illustrate how you apply B70, if this is what you ask. In no way, that was not the purpose of this paper. Right. The paper was to illustrate how you work out around paragraph B68, given that you have...
That's what I was trying to make. We're trying to confirm the process you need to go through.
Yes, I understand. So I just say, if it's possible in your conclusion or summary, just to make clear, because some people read this paper, got different view, and they're quite there are quite concerns that because in real cases it's quite difficult to follow this procedure to get cash flow. That's my point.
Okay, thanks. Mary?
I think the point I would make is that we are seeing both the benefits of an example, and I think this example helps to illustrate B68. We are, as Daryl has said, seeing the limitations of an example. And my sense is that around this table, I think perhaps the challenge to us is to come back with an example. And there are very many practical examples where you cannot allocate cash flows so precisely because the sharing takes place at a higher level. And the point, to my mind, that is important is the reading not only of B70, but also we've also got paragraph 24, which is reflecting the fact that we may have to make approximations because a lot of the sharing does take place at a higher level. We do that first, then we see the results.
Okay, Leslie?
Just one last comment on just from picking up on Sir Chong's point. You said the entity is affected. You could take the perspective that the entity is actually not affected because the total amount that the entity will recognize remains 600. All you've done is put 300 loss into this year and pushed 900 into the future
affected
recognition.
Well, it's by group.
It's by group.
It's affected by group, not by a portfolio or by a whole entity. It's definitely not affected by a single contract. So it has the group perspective in mind.
Understood. Okay. But the total was unaffected.
But
what it says.
B68 does say the group. So that is the perspective you have to look at.
Okay, Gail?
I think I was going to say something similar to Mary, that I think based on the fact pattern as written here, we concluded we did agree with example two, but it is the fact pattern here. And so I absolutely agree. In a different fact pattern, where allocation is different, you might come with something different. So, but we did agree with the analysis.
And the cash flows are different.
Thanks. I guess I'm just going to echo a couple of the comments that were already made. One is I struggled, like Sichong, on finding a real-world analogy for the example. It seemed extreme, and it just made it more difficult to actually get through the analysis. But I think it does reflect, the analysis does reflect what IFRS 17 is saying. And it only make the observation that, and Leslie was touching on this, that on the face of the statement, you will have a CSM, an example two, of 900 at the end, when in reality, if everything works out for these contracts as expected, you will only get 600 from the entity. You only realize 600 in profit. 300 of that is related to Group 1. It's in the loss component and disclosed, right, but not shown on the face of the statement. So there will have to be supplementary information to give in, you know, to really explain what the true profit measure is expected for the group.
Perhaps a service margin won't be on the face of the statement financial. I mean, you'll have to go to the notes to understand
the disclosure.
The
amount of the CSM is not going to be the amount of total profit you're expecting on that profit. That's my only point. You'll have to explain it.
Well, you'll have recognized the loss, so it will be the amount
loss.
Good.
I just want to make sure I understand, because now I'm a bit confused. Are you saying you wouldn't recognise the 300 loss component?
No, you would recognise the 300. So it's timing. I'm saying that in terms of the future profit that you would expect from this group is going to be 600 in total. You've recognised it in different timing.
Yes.
And that's what needs to be explained.
Okay, Francesca?
I wanted to suggest that there is another way to look at the fact pattern in terms of the allocation of the cash flows and the fact that you can interpret B68 as the donor groups 2 to 10 effectively gifting the group 1 that is suffering the loss with 400 currency units each. In that case, actually, you have the groups coming up with a CSM of 60, each of them, which proves then that in that case, the group individual CSM and the sum of those CSM is the same as you would, the one you would obtain from applying the same logic at the portfolio level. It seems that the staff did not consider that particular way of looking at the fact pattern in the examples, and I just wonder why was that that you have not taken that into account?
Well, the figures we've come up with in our analysis are what we think you get to if you apply B68 to this fact pattern.
So you don't think that the B68 will allow you to come up with 400?
No.
I understand, because I think it does, but I just want to understand why is it that you can't get to 400?
Well, again, if you look at the tables on page 14, you know, in you're looking at what are the fulfillment cash flows in group one if groups 2 to 10 don't exist, compared to what are the cash flows to the policyholders in groups one if groups 2 to 10 do exist. That is what you use to apply paragraph B68. That is what the words of B68, I believe, tell you to do. So
I read the B68 words as well, and I believe that in this fact pattern, the contract will require the donor groups to give 400 to the group one that suffers the loss, not 360.
But there
seems that there is an agenda here, but you said that we clearly miss the reading of B68, but all the people so far, well, most of the people so far that they're speaking, I heard them saying that they read the B68 words in the same way as I did, and I don't see why 400 is the wrong answer.
I think where we might all be talking around, the words we might be talking around is this to the extent, and then the paragraph goes on to say hence. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to differentiate between those cash flows that affect the entity and those that don't. If I look at the words are clearly saying to the extent that they affect, so that seems to be making that separation. Mm-hmm. And then the A and B of that section are saying hence. It's telling me that's what I'm trying to achieve, this is the way I achieve it. And I think that's what has led us to the conclusion of the 10% clearly impacts the entity. And I agree with you, the policyholders are making a gift from one group to the other. But 10% of that gift is my money. 90% of it is affecting their eventual outcome, and 10% of it is affecting my eventual outcome.
Don't see it like that. I see that the policyholders have, of the group that are effectively making the gift, they got the obligation accepted in the contract to effectively give 400 to the group that has made the loss, not 360. I take my 10%.
They've got the obligation to give 360, and I've got the obligation to give 40. And I think that's the difference.
I don't understand why.
How are you reading to the extent?
Because that is the claim that has been arising from the 10 contract. So this is like 10 groups of drivers. This is a 1-year motor insurance policy. One group of drivers has had an accident. The other 9 groups have to pay for that claim, and then they share the profit, and I take 10%.
I think you've got a different fact pattern, because I think what you're doing is you're sharing everything between the groups and then taking the entity into account. Whereas I think what Daryl's saying, and this is what the fact pattern is, because the 4,000 come from group one, is that the entity shares in the 10% of the net before. You're spreading it at a different level from what the fact pattern is.
And that's what we were saying, is that there could be a difference.
Here it says 4,000 belong to group one, so 4,000 belong to group one. There's no way to share that between groups 2 to 10.
Actually, I don't see why you're saying that I don't read the fact pattern as it is written, because I believe I do. And I see that the extent that Darren was referring to is to the 4,000. And that's where you got to start with. You need to accept that when you have these words as they are written, you can read that this allocation requires the donor groups to give 400 to the loss-making group. Then you have to do the 10% split.
They also share the group one. It doesn't just get 4,000 from the other groups. It gets the 4,000 and then shares in the profit or loss. And so the net amount that it gets from the other groups isn't 4,000, it's 3,240.
No, but that's, you see, if you put yourself in the shoes of that policyholder, okay, the policyholder in that group, say it's one per group, just to make it simple, but that person has got the accident. Yeah. The car has an accident. So he gets the money to pay the 4,000, but then he gets nothing else.
No, but he has to.
But that's not fair, because they all agreed that they're going to get their share of the profit as well. 90% of the profit has to come to them. So that is true for group one, as it is true for group two, three,
yeah,
up to 10.
And that's,
but the only way to do that is for the groups two to 10 to give 400 to group one. Otherwise, group one will not make the same money as the other policyholders. So don't look at the CSM. Look at the policyholders in the first place.
Well,
the contract, the fact pattern says that these policyholders have accepted to share in the experience of this risk, which is producing a claim of 4,000. And so in order for them to actually share the surplus that is produced by that difference between the premium and the claims, the only way you can get the equity across the 10 groups is for the donor group to pay 400 to the loss-making group. There is no other way.
Yes,
and that's the way why I think 68 is...
But that's not the only thing that happens. They do get the 4,000 as a claim, but then they also share in the return. And you have to, you can't ignore that bit. You can't say, oh, I'm just getting 4,000 from these other groups. I'm getting 4,000 and then I'm getting my share. And you have to look at both of them together. You can't ignore the fact. You can't say, oh, I'm okay in group one. I've just got my claim. End of story.
No, in fact, quite the contrary. This is exactly what I'm saying.
But we're discussing here is the examples with its impact on the CSM, I think. That is what we're discussing, right?
Absolutely.
And do you use annual cohorts, yes or no? And I clearly think this has an impact on the CSM that was demonstrated in the example. And you're discussing different fact
patterns. I'm not, Martin. I'm not discussing a different fact pattern at all. You are accusing me of that, but it's not true.
But you would say, okay, it has not an impact on the CSM, which is not true, because when we are saying it has an impact because you...
That's the point of discussion. Yeah. So I read the words, and I heard at least another two or three members of the TRG reading the same words in the way B68 is applied.
I think what I've heard from most TRG members that they are very much focused on B70. So I heard, I think, quite clear there's a lot of judgment involved in that allocation, and this allocation may end up that after you do this allocation and you do B68, you might end up in a situation that, you can apply the measurement at a higher level and get to the same outcome. What I've heard is that there is a discussion about B70 that was not part of this paper.
And I agree with you.
Okay. And then given that B70 is assumed to be applied in this fact pattern, and these are the numbers, I did not hear a lot of controversial notes about how B68 need to be applied. B68 need to be applied from an entity perspective, because it's the entity that prepares financial statements. It needs to look at the CSM and the way that it is affected by the policyholder. This fact pattern is different than the fact pattern that we have in the standard, because there is just a guarantee. Here is a guarantee, which is a claim and a sharing. Those have a different impact than the one in the paper. So I think that I did hear an agreement on how we have applied B68 for most members, or on how we apply B68, given that these are the numbers after you apply B70, which is something that is not on the table at the moment. That is where I landed, but maybe you want to see that.
That was also my understanding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Mary put it very eloquently, and so did Gail. But I think, you know, this debate, I think it's a function that, well, I don't think it's clear that, I think there are two interpretations, you know, say Chung's analysis of the numbers. It's not clear whether the guarantee effectively is before or after the profit sharing. And I think both circumstances happen in practice. And so that's why I think we think there are potentially different numbers from the same fact pattern, and I suppose this, and I take the point that this is the submission that you were given, but I think it's then applied in such limited circumstances to a situation that hardly ever exists in practice that, for me, it hasn't really helped with the interpretation of the standard.
But wasn't the question? The question for me was really simple. It's because if you have some kind of consolation, could you assume that you're applying this kind of don't have to prove and you'll go out the same result? No, there are circumstances where clearly in this fact pattern that was submitted to us, you cannot assume that. That was what we have answered. Now people doing quite a lot of interpretations in this kind of specific examples, which I think was not the topic of this paper. And I really mind that we can discuss it forever, but I think that was not the purpose. The purpose was clearly to make clear that, okay, in this fact pattern which was submitted, can I assume, okay, that I can apply this and don't have to use any cohorts? No, there is circumstances where you can, but others clearly demonstrate you can't. That was the purpose of the paper.
I thought the heart of it was a very...
Now we're discussing things which is different and...
What assessment do you need to make?
It is not helpful because then we cannot agree, we don't have a paper on this other things and different purpose. And that we can discuss it all over the place and then we...
I'm not quite sure that we need a paper for every specific fact pattern that is out there. I think this is an exercise that practice need to go through. I think we've illustrated both edges of the analysis. There is one that it seems very clear. I know that it doesn't make a lot of sense to some of you, but it is an example, and it is mutuals maybe have that. And there is another example that shows that it doesn't work. There is something there in the middle. It's not a free exercise that you can just play with the numbers. We have B70 you need to go through, and then you apply B68, and we try to illustrate how you apply B68. And what I've heard is that you think that how we illustrated how you apply B68 works. You didn't recognize the fact pattern as something that is familiar, but I think that what we could do is take this back and apply this to the fact pattern that you are familiar with and start testing whether it works or it doesn't for your scenarios. But I don't know if we can do that live or at least in the TLG at all. Okay.
I was going to pick up on your point right at the end there, and I was going to respond originally to Mary's point about additional examples. And then sort of let it go. But since Joe raised it again, I've got an excuse to bring it up now. So I mean, I do think examples play a useful space, but I think the moment you try to complicate examples with too much information, you start getting yourself into the space of interpreting real life. And I think what we've learned with insurance is every example in the real life world is slightly different from every other one. And so I think it's quite useful in many ways that we take two extremes and say, look, that's one extreme, that's another extreme. Now go away and think where you live on that scale between the two of them. And then the other point I'd say, I think it is important that we make very clear that nothing in this is saying we're interpreting 24 or B70. Because I think that's a lot of the discussion has been about those two paragraphs, and that's not what this discussion paper is actually about. I think it's important that's clear.
Kevin?
I guess I'm a little worried about this paper and this example, you know, because we say it's a specific fact pattern, but it's giving people some guidance to go away and look at what they would do in their circumstances. And I feel like there's a very large number of people here who are uncomfortable with the outcome of the second example. And I think we've talked past each other quite a lot, so I'm not even sure I'd agree that our disagreement is as Haggard summarized it. On the one hand, you've got this 0-100 mutual 100% sharing that you say, you know, does meet the requirements of the paragraph, and then you're saying, here's the other one that doesn't. But the only thing you've changed is the percentage, right? So if you made it 99%, you'd come at the same. Made it 72%, you come the same. So it feels like the only way you'll ever get there is in a Nord 100 fund. And as we said, that's really unusual. Right? There's a couple in the UK if you're mutual. And then it feels like paragraph B, C, 138, why would you write it for such a small application? You know what I mean? and so I feel like the point that maybe we're uncomfortable with, and I think that the staff feels is right, is this thing of the fact that the shareholder gets less because of a result of one of the groups, you think means that that group is onerous. Mm-hmm. And I think when we think, well, what is profit sharing, what is mutualization? Mutualization benefits the shareholder as well as the policyholders because, you know, we don't make a loss because that loss is borne by some of the other groups of policyholders. And I think that conclusion feels wrong. And if you know you did a set of accounts and you said I've got a loss component of 300, you have to justify to your, you know, shareholders what that means. All it really means is I would have got more profit from the other groups this year if this wasn't there, which doesn't really sound like a loss component like the other ones are. And you know, that may be the conclusion that you have to get to from these words, but I feel like that's what we're uncomfortable with. And then and going, if this example is out there, it seems to always suggest that that will be the case when this happens, right? That you're always going to, as long as the policy, as long as the shareholders' share is different because of one group, you know, made a loss, you're going to get there. So we could say there's different facts and circumstances, but this will still apply if we get you, even if the cash flows are done differently or whatever. And I feel like it's that conclusion that we're not comfortable with.
I think I'll just say something small. I think that in this example, too, we have a combination of two things. One of them is that it's not 100, it's something less, which I agree with you. But the other thing that we have is we have a distinct cash flows that are allocated to group one, which is that 400. We were given with this fact pattern. This is what makes it, I think, extreme to some of you, because I think you would not see that. You would identify maybe all the cash flows, the outflows with one group and the other. So a combination of we're going from 100 to something less and the specific fact pattern that identify all the claims with one group and not the other created this outcome. So it's not just by moving from 100 to something that is less than 100, is those cash flows. And again, we do not challenge this. It could be, and it's probably very reasonable, that you wouldn't assume that all the claims will end in one group. So I think it's a combination of those two that get us to that outcome.
I want to remind us, I think when, if you look at the basis of conclusion, when the board was not willing to describe, okay, in which kind of mutualization we give this exemption and say you don't have to, because we found it too difficult to make that. And therefore, what we said, if you can demonstrate that you have the same outcome numbers-wise, you can do that. But now we're trying in this to get kind of to make that, because but the board was not, I think, able and willing to do that because we found it too difficult.
I'd probably go a step further than that. I don't think the board was even thinking of this as a relief. It was a statement of the obvious. Yeah. If you can get the same outcome doing a different approach, absolutely.
You would get the same thing without
think,
the BC.
I think if this had been something where we felt had, where we were actively providing a relief, I think we would have been, we would have put it in the standard.
But you use the word fully shared risks, and I think this is implying that fully shared risks is only 0-100.
I think in terms of, I think in terms of this type of structure, yes, it probably is. But I think it does depend on exactly how you are sharing.
And having said that, man, is there anything which this contribute to? Because man, I'm, you say, okay, not everybody is agreeing to example two. I think everybody has agreed to example two, but with something different, which is, okay, the conclusion in example two, I think nobody has disagreed with that. I have not heard that. So.
Just building on what Daryl said, I think if the group was able to make the observation that that basis paragraph was merely observing the fact that you need to apply annual cohorts unless another method would give you the same outcome, I think that would be a source of education for the market without getting into whether or not the TRG agrees with example two or not, or the allocation discussion, which I don't. Seems to me we're not going to conclude today, but I think that simple observation, which I think that would be helpful.
Okay, Joe.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the impression this, the, you know, it's kind of to Kevin's point. I think why people feel uncomfortable with this paper is the impression it gives is that it's only this extremely rare circumstance that this applies to, and I think there is more judgment than that. And when our allocation is at a higher level, there's definitely more judgment in terms of how you allocate those cash flows and whether the outcome is the same or not. And so that's why I, you know, find this paper unhelpful in interpretation. But I take Sue's point that I think the standard is saying that, you know, you need annual cohorts unless you can demonstrate the accounting outcome is the same. I think that is what the standard says, but I think there's more judgment in that assessment than is indicated by this paper.
Okay, JP?
Yes, thank you. I have just a quick comment. Considering all the discussions that we had so far, I get to realize that there is a situation where insurers are allowed to measure CSM at a higher level than the annual cohort. In that case, I think, you know, we need to think about whether it is necessary to revisit the paragraph 78 of presentation requirement at a group level. If insurers are allowed to measure CSM at a higher level, at a portfolio level, but because of this 78 paragraph, now we are restricted to present the measurement at a portfolio level. So it conflict with, you know, the group requirement. So why don't you think about this presentation requirement in paragraph 78?
Sergio?
Thank you. Acknowledge what Sue mentioned, and you know, I need to reconcile what was in example two versus the standard. Yeah, I take note of comments from Francesco, Kevin, and others. You know, you look at the B68. You know, at the time of writing the standard, what they have in mind is B69. And in B69, there's no uncertainty that the full extent of the cash flow effect here is 100. It's not about 90. So I need to reconcile, you know, this B69 example two. You know, the only thing I can say is example two is extremely rare. It wasn't in the mind of the board here when they wrote the B69.
Sally?
Thank you. By hearing Francisco and Kevin saying, I think everyone here just feel the sample two is not feel right because it recognized group one 300 loss. When we think about it, it's a profit sharing, we don't think we make any losses in this case. So if you look at A14 on page 14, I'm just thinking whether is that possible that the line of share of return on pool, the figures are not correct, because on each group of group 2 to 10, you conclude the net cash flow is 100. But when we think about sharing, if on all, the result might be should be 60. And then 60 to each group for the net cash flow. On that cases, the result, the answer, the conclusion will be different. Because that's our understanding of sharing. After sharing, or each group, whatever, which group made a claim, each group give us 60 for the result. That's my...
And I think we discussed it already. If different, then it's different. Mm-hmm. Okay. And try
okay.
Summary.
So for the summary, I would say that the TRG agrees that... You don't need to use annual cohorts only if you would get to the same answer by doing something at a higher level as you would using annual cohorts, and that's the principle. I think the TRG is concerned that the examples in the paper are unrealistic and too extreme, and in particular example two assumes that you do not, that you're not applying B70, you're not in the situation of applying B70, whereas in these sorts of situations you, I think, are saying we always would be in the situation where we couldn't attribute the cash flows directly to the groups, and we would be doing some sort of allocation on a systematic and rational basis. And therefore, having example two without thinking about the situation where you'd need to apply B70 is unrealistic and sends the wrong message.
I'm sure that the TRG altogether said that this was unrealistic and unhelpful. I heard many, Jens, I heard Gail saying that this was a helpful paper. So, okay. So I don't think that there is a TRG view the way you describe it.
I think
some TRG members.
I think the summary would not relate
some
to
members
any
may have
specific
said that.
Fact pattern because it's unhelpful. I think that what we need to say in that summary that TRG members noticed that before you apply B68, you first apply B70 to determine those cash flows, and then you apply B68. To reflect the impact of mutualization. But I think the key comment that was made that you can, if you prove it, you can get to a measurement at a higher level that will result in the same outcome. You need to go through the process together. I do not know if there is anything that we can add without causing damage to this one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Haggit.
Welcome.
Then okay. We go to...